Hey, it's Weasel. You're listening to Talk Today's Top and Trendy Technology Topics every Tuesday and Thursday with Adam Lepp, the computer guy, between 2:13 p.m. and 3 right here on The Talking Place, WWGH 107.1.
And a very good Tuesday morning to you. Thank you, Weasel, for that outstanding introduction. It's time to talk today's top and trendy technology topics with me, Adam Lepp, the computer guy. If you saw my Facebook post, we've got some good stuff to talk about today. Biometrics at airports, in your office. Take a look at a computer, not just using a password to make sure that it's being authenticated, but can look at your iris, your retina, your fingerprints, and maybe other body parts. Biometric screening certainly has been around a while. Fingerprints, we will learn, have been around as an identification tool since the late 1800s, but the technology certainly continues to advance every day. Of course, what are the privacy considerations? Do companies get a hold of your information about your body parts, and use it for monetization or other possible ulterior motives? We'll talk about that. Also talk about synthesizing speech from brainwaves, a fascinating topic, to say the least. And again, if there's ever something you want to talk about that is tech-related, or again, related to fascinating things that scientists and researchers are doing, self-driving vehicles, autonomous vehicles, that's a popular topic, robotics, artificial intelligence, so many things to talk about, not to mention all the security considerations with modern technology. That is all fair game, and I'd love for you to provide input as to what you think might be a good topic. You can send me an email, and you know we do have a private email server, just like Hillary. The email address is adam@wwgh1071.com. Before we talk about the biometrics and the speech synthesis that will be the main topics of today's show, speaking of security, let's talk about Capital One. And I have Capital One credit cards, as do many people. And certainly you have heard about the data breach and what exactly is going on. Are you and I as a Capital One cardholder, which I've been for many, many years, are we at risk? In late July, Capital One Financial announced a data breach affecting 100 million people, almost a third the population of this country, in the United States, and 6 million in Canada. Thankfully, the FBI arrested the alleged perpetrator of the breach in Seattle. On July 19th, Capital One discovered someone had accessed its data stored online and obtained personal information of credit card customers and people who had applied for credit card products. No credit card account numbers or login credentials were compromised in the breach, which is believed to have lasted for 5 months, from mid-March to July 17th. However, the intruder accessed 140,000 Social Security numbers and 80,000 bank account numbers belonging to secured credit card customers. Secured credit cards are issued to people who have no credit or low credit. You make a deposit in the bank, and that's used as collateral in case you don't pay your bill. Based on its analysis to date, Capital One believes it is unlikely that the information was used in any widespread attacks. Former FBI agent Leo Taddeo, who is now with Sixtera Technologies, a secure infrastructure platform provider in Florida, said, "It appears that the breach was discovered before the alleged hacker had a chance to widely disseminate the information for exploit. So if no additional hackers had access to the same entry point, there is a chance the breach was contained. Affected people will be notified through a variety of channels, and free credit monitoring and identity protection services will be made available to everyone impacted by the event. Capital One expects to incur costs related to the breach of between $100 and $150 million this year." Richard D. Fairbank is Capital One's CEO. And what did he have to say about this? "Well, I am grateful that the perpetrator has been caught. I am deeply sorry for what has happened. I sincerely apologize for the understandable worry this incident must be causing those affected, and I'm committed to making it right." And that's from Capital One CEO Richard Fairbank. While he was apologizing for the data breach, the FBI was busy arresting Paige A. Thompson, age 33, a former Amazon software engineer, for this breach. Thompson was identified as the alleged perpetrator after she bragged on GitHub about stealing Capital One's data, according to a criminal complaint filed in federal court in Seattle. And GitHub is a website for software developers. Now, she said she accessed the data by exploiting a misconfigured firewall set up to protect the data stored in the Amazon Web Services cloud. A GitHub user who saw Thompson's comments alerted Capital One. Capital One told the FBI, which obtained a search warrant for Thompson's residence. There, the agents seized electronic storage devices containing a copy of Capital One's data. So Paige Thompson, again, the 33-year-old hacker who caused this serious security breach at Capital One, she will face charges of computer fraud and abuse, punishment up to 5 years in prison and $250,000. Now, the experts feel Capital One was fairly lucky. This could have been a lot uglier. Satya Gupta, chief technology officer of Versec, an applications security company in San Jose, said the attacker was careless and boastful. She was very proud of what she did, but she bragged to the wrong people. She should have kept her mouth shut if she wanted to get away with this. But people are like that. They get the big egos and it takes over. Most hackers, again, according to Satya Gupta, an expert in this field, most hackers trying to promote their own skills will get caught. It's more disturbing that the hacker was not noticed by either Capital One or Amazon Web Services who employed her. They had no clue until after the fact. For Capital One, it was fortuitous that the individual who alerted them to the breach seems to have been one of the good guys. Nevertheless, there still may be cause for concern, noted Arjun Sethi, a partner and vice chair of the digital transformation practice at A.T. Kearney, a global strategy and management consulting firm in Chicago. He said regarding the vulnerable web app, "We don't know if that vulnerability was compromised by prior intruders or if the data exposed in the current attack was left open for others to leverage. Botching a firewall setup is a frequent issue in network security," noted Usman Rahim, digital security and operations manager at the Media Trust, a mobile and website application security company in McLean, Virginia. He said companies routinely manipulate firewall configuration in order to achieve the desired results at any legitimate point where the web application can be accessed. However, in the process, they run the risk of misconfiguring the firewall. Sophisticated attackers know full well how services operate in the cloud, including the common mistakes around firewall configuration. Terrence Jackson is a security expert at Thycotic, a maker of enterprise password management software in D.C. He said the misconfigured firewall permitted unauthorized access to Capital One's data, but the inability to detect the issue for months also was an issue. Why was it going on for 4 months? I'd ask the same question. Dwell time has been an issue in other high-profile breaches as well. Companies must continuously audit configurations of these cloud services to ensure gaps like these are closed. From a technical point of view, Amazon's cloud is very difficult to breach. Nearly all breaches where Amazon Web Services is involved are a result of human error or intent rather than a technical exploit. Based on what we know, we'd wager the firewall misconfiguration was more likely a result of malicious insider action, the alleged hacker taking advantage of privileges she should not have had. Still, if it's a result of a true misconfiguration, the fact remains that we're all still vulnerable to the mistakes that people can make, even skilled security practitioners. Now, critics of cloud migration may use the Capital One breach to bolster their position that the public cloud is unsafe for critical data. But that would be a mistake. According to Richard Gold, a security expert in San Francisco, he is with Digital Shadows. He said this is not a doom and gloom scenario for the cloud. Attacks like this underscore the need to know your cloud environment very well, but the misconfiguration that the attacker took advantage of was probably preventable, the result of human error. The ability of Capital One to respond so quickly was partly due to the instrumentation provided by Amazon Web Services. People need to be proactive about checking their cloud environments to ensure the security groups, networks, and so forth are configured in a way that they're expected to be. Consumers also may want to be proactive in light of the Capital One breach. It's a good idea to review password usage and avoid using passwords more than once. Monitoring credit and financial transactions for a while also might be a valuable exercise. So if you're a Capital One customer like I am, this will be a good time to change your password and look at all your accounts and make sure there's nothing funky on them. Good advice. Won't cost you anything, and it won't take a lot of time either. Ted Rossman is with CreditCards.com in Austin, Texas. He said the number one thing consumers should do to protect their identities is to freeze their credit by contacting Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, the major credit reporting agencies. It's free, quick, and easy. You can do it online or over the phone. He said that's the best way to prevent a criminal from opening an unauthorized account in your name. Unfortunately, only about 1 in 4 adults have frozen their credit. So in 2019, keeping an eye on security as a credit card user, it's important. You know, technology gets good, but if there are security holes, then we can have some problems that are expensive and not to mention embarrassing. Adam Lepp here, the computer guy, with news and views from the world of technology, here on The Talking Place, WWGH Radio. Adam Lepp.
Love the cool things we can do. We can do, we can do. We love the cool things we can do on our computer.
When you need to talk technology, no one gets you more gigs in your hard drive than Adam. It's time for Adam the Computer Guy with Adam Lepp.
Biometric screening, where your fingerprint, your eye, or some other body part is used as identification. It's been used at airports, certainly making security more efficient and less invasive. Well, United Airlines recently announced it would begin rolling out biometric pre-screening at its hub airports, including Houston's George Bush Intercontinental and Newark Liberty International in the New York City area. It verifies a flyer's fingerprints or eye scan. Now, Clear is the company behind this biometric airport screening. It's available at about 60 locations currently across the USA, has a system that utilizes biometrics to speed pre-approved travelers to the front of the security lane. In fact, even ahead of the TSA pre-check flyers. United joins Delta. Of course, Delta with a big hub in Cincinnati and a lot of flights in most of the big airports here in Ohio. So they're kind of a regional story here. Delta, United offer the service to flyers. Again, it's a biometric screening, makes things faster, and I would say also more certain. This technology, again, by a company called Clear, also is in use at participating stadiums and arenas that require an ID check for entry. But Clear is just one of several companies to begin developing this biometric screening technology, and airports already have been struggling with how to deal with competing but not compatible systems. In fact, check this out. There are now at least 53 biometric systems used just by the aviation industry and dozens more by other industries, according to the World Travel and Tourism Council. Most don't see eye to eye in that their respective databases aren't shared. Of course, that's also kind of a pun, since the eye scan is part of the biometric screening. Leave it to me to figure something like that out. Now, getting all these competing systems to work together is just one of the challenges that biometric screening companies will have to deal with in the near future to make this technology universally embraced as an alternative to traditional identification. Now, it's easy to think of technology that can recognize a unique fingerprint instantly. Certainly, if you watch Discovery ID like I do, you see forensic experts using fingerprints to find people rather quickly, and that certainly has been a tremendous crime fighter. Also saves money, and it's kind of fun, I guess, also, just to see how amazing and how fast that this methodology is. But the roots of fingerprinting as a method of identification in forensics goes back actually to the end of the 1800s. I wasn't around then, but, you know, late 1800s. My great-grandparents were born during that time. Juan Vucetich is an Argentinian anthropologist. He first cataloged fingerprints way back in 1891. That's 20 years before my maternal grandmother was born, so you know, I can at least get perspective there. Now, just 2 years later, in 1893, that helped Inspector Eduardo Alvarez identify Francisca Rojas as the actual killer of her two sons. Again, way back before 1900. Then there is a story of Will and William West, two men who were unrelated, yet nearly identical in appearance, not to mention in names. Each was serving a prison sentence at Leavenworth Penitentiary in Kansas, but Will West was convicted of a minor crime, while William West already was serving a life sentence for first-degree murder. The prison had almost no way of telling the men apart, but then turned to a new technology, fingerprint identification. Alphonse Bertillon is a French handwriting expert and early biometrics researcher. He had already created an identification system that included a so-called mugshot, along with detailed description of an inmate's facial features. Normally, that system was given to differentiate, was enough to differentiate individuals from one another. But, you know, if they look alike, then it's a bit of a different issue. But the two West men, not only with similar names, but similar appearances, it was kind of hard to tell. And again, you grow a beard, gain or lose some weight, put on some makeup, I mean, comb your hair differently, then it really gets complicated. But the fingerprint, that's not likely to change. Now, as it happens, again, Alphonse Bertillon, a early biometrics researcher, handwriting expert from France, he had also made a breakthrough in the advancement of dactyloscopy. Now, what is dactyloscopy? Well, that can analyze the patterns of fingerprints. See, there's a name for that. As each individual's fingerprints are unique, it was enough to determine which West was which. Ralph Russo, director of the School of Professional Advancement Information Technology Program at Tulane University, says, "Biometrics have been around as identifiers and authentication means for over 100 years, with the most well-known case being that of police and law enforcement use of fingerprints. The system of fingerprint identification is just one of the unique identifiers that can tell individuals apart. In the century since Bertillon developed dactyloscopic technology," or maybe it's dactyloscopic. Well, I guess either one is probably okay. "In the century, again, since that was developed, again, late 1800s, there have been many advances that can also scan an individual's retina, the eye scan we've talked about. Retina is as unique as a fingerprint. In addition, there have also been great strides in facial recognition." And if you are a user of the Facebook Face app, where it makes you older, gives you a beard, glasses, hair color change, weight change, you know exactly what I'm talking about, and it also can recognize who might be in a photo. It might say, well, this looks like your father or your dog, etc., and usually it's right. So you can certainly tell how that's been used, not just in criminology, but in fun. Both fingerprints and facial recognition scanning have been adopted in recent years as a way to unlock smartphones, with your fingerprint and other body features. Supporters of this biometric technology have suggested that they offer a greater level of security over passwords. And again, passwords you can forget, but your fingerprint, your retina, that's probably not going to change. Leanne Galloway is a cybersecurity resilience lead at Positive Technologies, and she said the main advantage of the biometric authentication is its ease of use for the end user. Simplicity and information security is not always good. The face and fingerprints are always with you. You will not forget them as a password, but you cannot change them either. The advantages of using digital biometrics, including fingerprints, iris scans, or facial recognition to manage access to applications and devices include fast and reliable access to information tied to a specific person, as well as very high accuracy. In addition, biometrics, again, as a password, you cannot lose or forget. Your iris, your retina, your fingerprints, that's not going to change. Again, even with facial recognition, it can usually still know who you are if you grow a beard or change your weight or hair color, but there are some limitations, not to mention plastic surgery. That can certainly change your bone structure and facial structure, and more than likely fool even the smartest of the facial scanning technologies. Therefore, if you're a business owner like I am, you've certainly had people who may work for you or that you've helped with their computers, and they forget their password, and that can be a problem. Sometimes you can reset it easily with a few tricks, or sometimes you have to go in and buy a whole new computer, or even call the company that provides a software product, and they have a way of getting in through a back door. Sometimes you have to pay for that also. The bottom line is, with biometrics, those problems become almost non-existent. Biometrics can be used as part of a multi-factor authentication process where you put one password in and then it might send you a text code to your phone, or it calls you by an automated voice and you type in another number, or again, it uses your fingerprint or other body part as a secondary password, making things very secure and almost impossible to hack into someone's account. Now, with the two-factor authentication, again, the problem is if you don't have the ability to go through these steps, that's what I wanted to say. For example, sometimes people request two-factor authentication, but it is texted, the code is texted to a phone you don't have anymore, or there's a problem with your service, and what do you do? Well, you have to go through a third method, and sometimes that third method will be even more complicated. And that can certainly result in some embarrassing and expensive problems. Also, with respect to passwords, no password is truly perfect, although you can certainly use a password that's complicated with a combination of characters, numbers, and letters, and uppercase, lowercase. Technology to guess passwords is getting smarter every time, and you have to kind of keep up with that. No longer can you just use a word as your password. You have to use a word without non-alphanumeric characters, a dollar sign, percentage sign, underscore, numbers, mix uppercase and lowercase. Just try to do everything you can to outsmart those hackers, because they get smarter and smarter every single day. And also, when people write down passwords, they sometimes put them on a post-it note in a conspicuous location. And if someone does happen to get access to your equipment physically, well, the password comes along with it. So not only might you forget the password if you don't have it committed to memory, that person will have it sitting there in plain text, in plain sight. Experts expect the use of biometrics to increase at an increasing rate going forward. And it's for many reasons, including convenience to the user, lower cost for the business. I mean, again, the cost of losing a password, or to goodness sakes, if you do end up having passwords stolen. But again, with biometrics, your iris or retina scan, your fingerprint is unique. and that has many advantages, especially in the business setting where you want to be sure things are secure, but again, not so secure that you forget how to log into something or forget what your login information is. Once users have chosen their type of biometric authentication, there's no need to type on a tiny keyboard, no phone calls, and no text with a code that's sent from your bank or other place that you're logging into. And wherever you go, you always have your hands and your face with you. So it's also portable. So many advantages to biometric authentication methods. And as a two-factor, as long as you don't forget anything and all the equipment works, well, you can not only know that it's very secure, but it's also portable and convenient. It can also be faster, as you don't have to type a password in. And even if you know your password, you still have to type it. And if it's one of those weird passwords, which has non-alphanumeric characters, numbers and letters and uppercase, lowercase, it's more complicated to type in than just a word, a dictionary word. But with biometric, again, you just take your fingerprint and you wipe the keyboard or other device, or you use your eye. Well, of course, you'd use your eye, but you look at whatever is scanning your eye, and it logs you in. And so convenience, and it's also kind of fun. A little bit spooky, though, too, because you wonder, well, is there a little man inside who sees my eye and sees my face and suddenly opens the door and lets me get access to this account? It's something, you know, your mother might tell you. Of course, that isn't the case, but it almost seems that way sometimes. So the other side of the issue is obviously privacy and security. We always look at that whenever we take a look at using technology, and is there a privacy violation, and exactly how secure is this? The city government of San Francisco has instituted a blanket ban on face recognition technology. In fact, California recently became the first state to consider a statewide ban on face recognition technology. So now the legislature gets into this, and what are they going to do? Well, Assembly Bill 1215, which is known as the Body Camera Accountability Act, has proposed a ban on facial recognition software in police body cameras due to privacy concerns. Similar concerns are being echoed regarding the use of fingerprints as a method of identification. And we talked about the CLEAR system being instituted by United Airlines, a biometric screening at airports. Well, travelers who see the benefits with this CLEAR or other biometric screening systems may want to consider if the cons may outweigh the pros. Sean McGrath, he is from Pro Privacy, a privacy advocate. He said, although it can shave a few minutes off of travel times, we'd recommend that travelers spend the extra few minutes in line to maintain sovereignty over their personal data. Both private companies, again, United Airlines and CLEAR, and the government have proven time and time again that they can't be trusted to keep the data secure. Well, can they? Well, I'm not really one to trust airlines, but they have a difficult job here. They certainly want to remain safe. They want to be sure that who gets on the airplane is someone who will be on the airplane and not do something that would be very bad. But where does that kind of intermingle, so to speak, with the privacy issue? A very tangled web we weave, for sure. Another concern is that once a fingerprint or eye scan is in the system, it isn't easy to get it back out again. You know, like Facebook taking your information and doing who knows what with it. So again, it gets complicated. As a travel authorities shift from using traditional technologies to biometrics, according to Sean McGrath, again, a privacy advocate, travelers are having less of a say of how their biometric data is used. There's another issue to consider, and that is the reliability of biometrics. Faces change with weight loss or gain, and people do look different as they age. I don't get older, I get better and better looking, but I don't know if everybody has that same progression. Fingerprints, while unique to individuals, do have similarities as well. And what about cuts or burns to a finger? Is it really such a perfect system for identification? Sean Galloway said, again, a privacy advocate, said, reading sensors and fingerprint processing algorithms have a certain threshold for sample compliance. I do apologize. This actually was not from Sean Galloway. His name is Sean McGrath. That was from Leanne Galloway. She's also in that business, a cybersecurity resilience lead. That's a pretty good title. At Positive Technologies. Considering possible damage or impurity of a finger, this threshold makes it possible to compromise the print. Thus, the higher the threshold, the more false negatives are possible. The lower, the more false positives are possible. And kind of like with a medical test, whatever. I mean, a pregnancy test, a test for a disease, and of course these DNA tests that everybody is interested in. How accurate are they? And certainly, we want 100% accuracy. Is 100% accuracy possible? While injury can interfere with the reading of a fingerprint, for comparison against a different image file stored in the database, most biometric systems encourage a second or tertiary print to be stored, as well as to allow access in these type of situations. Leanne Galloway, got her name right this time, said, in serious organizations, biometrics must be combined with other user verification tools, for example, finger plus eye plus password. Biometrics is not a perfect means of identifying users of applications and systems. Like anything involved with security, there is a balance between too much security and too little security. Dial up the percentage to declare a match and get more failures, false negatives, and user frustration. Dial down the percentage and get more false positives and weaker security. That's as opposed to passwords, which are 100% matches or not. The biggest consideration in biometrics is whether this information ever can be secure enough. Back in 2015, the Office of Personnel Management, known as OPM, was hacked, and personal information of more than 5 million people, including fingerprints, was compromised. Leanne Galloway said the biggest danger is the impossibility to change your biometric data. And you can't change your iris, can't change your fingerprint. Hacks and leaks have happened and will exist. There are no ideal systems. The biometric data used in our time is not a secret. Fingerprints can be restored by photo, voice, by calling and recording a sample, and the shape of the face by collecting photos of a target from social networks. If your password is hacked, you can always make a new one. But if biometric data is stolen, you couldn't realistically change your fingerprints, your face, or your iris, so that data could be used to attempt to fool devices and allow unauthorized access. However, this is not as easy to do as one might think. And while people have successfully replicated fingerprints and voice prints to fool systems, face ID secured systems are much harder to fool. In all, the incidence of using hacked biometrics to successfully gain access to systems have been minimal. Another consideration is that protecting biometric databases is not much different from protecting other forms of data stored within a given network, except maybe in how governments' accumulation of such data is rapidly outpacing their ability to secure it. And that comes from Christopher White, Assistant Professor of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness at Virginia Commonwealth University's L. Douglas Wilder School of Government and Public Affairs. Nice long title for that gentleman. He said, as recent breaches in Virginia and Tennessee and abroad have shown, massive leaks involving this kind of data are far from a fantasy. So again, how secure is this method of security? Even when it's protected, the question comes back to how well some of it works. He said biometric data actually does bring with it an added obstacle to security in that you need to actively work with the data to account for variations in the nature of relevant information. I, for instance, grew a beard last year. Not me. I can't even grow a beard. Plus, I don't look good with facial hair. I can't even grow sideburns. But this is referring to Christopher White, professor at Virginia Commonwealth University. His specialty is homeland security and emergency preparedness. So he grew a beard. Well, that's nice. He has a friend that lost 80 pounds 2 years ago. If I lost 80 pounds, I'd really be skinny. Anyway, both would have to be controlled by a facial recognition algorithm. This prevents at least some amount of a standard practice when it comes to minimizing the information stored by a company or organization that could actually be stolen or leaked. So, biometrics, a fascinating topic, which we've talked about with guests and callers sometimes, and like to cover this in detail. Quite cool and quite controversial. Again, the security, the privacy, the accuracy. So is always part of the equation. Researchers led by speech neuroscientist Edward Chang at the University of California in San Francisco recently reported their success at decoding speech attempts in real time by reading the activity in the speech centers of test subjects' brains. Check this out. Three people capable of normal speech who were being treated for epilepsy at their medical center, again at the UCSF, University of California at San Francisco, participated in the study. They permitted the researchers to make use of tiny recording electrodes that previously were placed on the surface of their brains to map the origins of their seizures in preparation for neurosurgery. This technique is called electrocorticography, or ECOG. It provides richer and more detailed data about brain activity than other technologies like electroencephalogram, EEG, or fMRI, magnetic resonance imaging. Because ECOG electrodes do not penetrate the brain tissue, they could be a better option for long-term brain-computer interfaces, known as BCIs, than electrodes physically inserted into the brain. Now, neuroscientist Edward Chang is a member of the Weill Institute for Neurosciences, again at his university in San Francisco. So his team asked the participants 9 simple predefined questions and gave them a choice of 24 possible answers. The research team developed machine learning algorithms to decode specific speech sounds from the test participants' brain activity. After some training, the algorithms were able to detect when participants were hearing a new question or beginning to respond, and to identify which of the 24 standard responses participants gave with up to 61% accuracy. The algorithm's speech and accuracy improved when they used the test subject's brain activity first to identify which of the predefined questions they had heard in order to provide context. And that method had 75% accuracy, not too bad. The technology could help people who have lost the ability to speak but still have cognitive capability that would allow understanding and the ability to form speech-related thoughts. That comes from somebody we quote often on the show, Rob Enderle from the Enderle Group. A very smart gentleman, for sure. However, training the algorithms could be very resource-intensive. Generally, that training would be part of getting the system linked to the individual's brain. Patients probably would have to get updated training every 6 to 12 months. Accuracy would need to exceed 90% to be practical for the rest of us, and 99% for general adoption. Again, it's about synthesizing speech from brain waves. Fascinating stuff. Well, Facebook, what do they have to do with this? Well, they got lots of money and lots of smart people, and they're in California. Facebook Reality Labs, FRL, funded this study as part of its Project Steno collaboration with the University of California at San Francisco. Facebook researchers have provided input and engineering support to Professor Chang's lab, but the university oversees the research program and works directly with volunteer subjects. The Facebook researchers have limited access to de-identified data, which remain on site at the university and under the university's control. Professor Chang's lab has launched another study, and it's called BRAVO, another great acronym, the BCI Restoration of Arm and Voice. And it is with Karunesh Ganguly, an associate professor of neurology at the university. That research aims to determine whether the ECOG neural interface implants can be used to restore movement and communication abilities to patients paralyzed due to brain or nerve issues. Facebook Research Labs is Facebook Reality Labs, FRL, is funding part of this BRAVO study, which is focused exclusively on demonstrating the ability to allow the participant to generate text on a computer screen using brain activity. The understanding is that the BRAVO study is broader in scope. Now, Facebook wants to use the technology for augmented reality glasses. And, of course, the privacy and other ethical issues comes into play, just like we just talked about with biometrics. Now, as you know from listening to this show, and if you read the news, you know that Facebook is not known for its adherence to user privacy principles. The Federal Trade Commission recently fined them $5 billion. Pocket change maybe to Mr. Zuckerberg, but not to me. Anyway, FTC recently fined Facebook 5 billion smackaroonies for breaching users' privacy, a penalty that people have criticized as not being enough. 5 billion. Furthermore, Facebook is part of the data transfer project with Apple, Google, and Twitter, an effort to develop interoperable systems to transfer data between services. Now, as you probably know, Facebook tracks people ubiquitously on the web through its Like button, which is used by more than 8 million websites, and its Facebook software development kits, which are embedded in more than 60% each of the top iOS and Android apps. That raises the question of whether the data gleaned from research into brain-computer interfaces is safe, and what ethical issues arise with related research and product development. The U.S. National Institutes of Health has developed a neuroethics roadmap for the National Institutes of Health Brain Initiative. The roadmap lists several neuroethics challenges: developing ethical standards of biological material and data collection, and evaluating how local standards compare to those of global collaborators, protecting the privacy of human brain data, understanding the moral significance of neural systems under development in neuroscience research labs, evaluating whether ethical standards for research are adequate and appropriate for evolving methodologies and brain models. So, what is the ethical question behind looking at brain waves and using it for something fascinating that can also help people with injuries or disabilities? Speech synthesis from brain waves. But like with any research of this kind, there are many ethical things to consider. Ray Wang is the principal analyst at Constellation Research, and he said right now there is a debate on whether the data aggregated and derived from research will be privately owned by an individual, collectively by society, or come under corporate ownership. Data derived from such research potentially could create a biological signature that is no longer unique and can be hacked. Other ethical questions are raised by what data has been captured and whether the data can adversely impact privacy. Facebook or the University of California at San Francisco could own the data from these research projects underway with Professor Chang's lab, but the issue still needs to be resolved. Personal data should be made a property right. Once that is done, We can transact, gift, trade, or lease that information for monetary or non-monetary reasons. Interesting perspective again from Ray Wang at Constellation Research. Rob Enderle, the expert we quoted earlier, said regulators should be surrounding this technology with laws that prevent abuse, but it might destroy much of the value of Facebook. Coming up later this afternoon, the Pastor's Spot with Pastor Steve Whitaker and, of course, Linda Sims, who joins the WWGH airwaves every Monday and Tuesday afternoon. Of course, if you ever miss a program on this radio station, that's okay. We won't take any points off. Just go to our website, WWGH1071.com, and you can listen on demand to thousands of shows for me, Scott, Linda, Pastor Steve Whitaker, Glenn Coble, Mike Wilson, and much, 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 much more. Speaking of great programs to listen to, be it the first time or for an encore, yesterday, legendary talk show host and Dayton native Phil Donahue spoke with the interviewer to the stars, Scott Spears, an exclusive extended interview. Phil Donahue doesn't give a lot of audio interviews anymore, but he talks to Scott. Also spoke with Scott live in New York City a while back. That's also in our show archives, but the interview yesterday with Scott, Phil Donahue, fascinating, obviously discussing the tragedy that took place in Dayton over the weekend, and much more. Always a great guest, Phil Donahue, a pioneer, and certainly someone who's influenced myself, Scott, and almost anybody who's at this radio station. Adam Lepp, thanking you for listening to the Adam the Computer Guy radio program. I'll talk to you again Thursday with more Tech Talk here on The Talking Place, AdamTheComputerGuy.com. See you later, alligator. She told me, nearly made me lose my head. When I thought of what she told me, nearly made me lose my head. But the next time that I saw her, reminded her of what she said. See you later, alligator. I said, wait a minute, gator. I know you mean it just for play.